Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this morning is William Hoffman, Vice President and Academic Dean at Eastern Mennonite University, and our topic will be Images of the Enemy in War. William, glad to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Hugh.
Let me just begin with an open-ended question. I take it that you have some interesting views about the standard images of the enemy in war. I wonder if you could briefly explain what those views are, and then we'll go back and look at each of the points in more detail.
Okay. Over the years, Hugh, I've thought about war quite a bit. I grew up in a family that was involved in war. My father was a veteran of World War II, and I grew up during the Vietnam War era. And so as I was growing up as a young man, I was thinking about war and my responsibility to war and how I might conduct myself in it. And I developed growing convictions that I couldn't participate in war, primarily because I saw persons who might possibly be my enemies as fellow human beings. And I didn't really think through that very well until when I was a young man in graduate school and I read a chapter in a book called The Warriors by Glenn Gray. The chapter was titled Images of the Enemy. And in that chapter, Glenn Gray talks about his experience during World War II, where he was an intelligence officer. And he describes in that chapter different images that warriors took toward their enemy. Some warriors saw the enemy that they were fighting as another military person in a sort of professional role, and they took one attitude toward them. Others saw their enemies as something less than human beings, often would use metaphors of some kind of animal behavior or some less than fully human being. Some saw their enemies as an instance of the devil, as the opposite forces of God and what was valuable. And still others saw the enemy as basically fellow human beings like themselves in a bad situation. And Glenn Gray in that chapter goes on to describe how the conduct of the soldier often reflected the image that soldier had of the enemy. That the more non-human the enemy was portrayed, the more violent, the more brutal, the more enthusiastic the warrior was in trying to kill the enemy. And so I think from my own personal experience trying to work through the issues of war and peace and how I treat other human beings, I found that chapter as a young man as being particularly insightful on how a behavior that if we were to do it out in the streets, we would think of as murder, or we would think of as something that we'd want to put persons in penitentiaries for. When we do it in war, sometimes we glorify it. And the only explanation I could have is because we construct certain images of our enemy that allow us to do things to them that we otherwise couldn't do.
Okay. Now, in Gray's account, one of the options you mentioned, though, was that you might see your enemy as simply just another person, but basically a person in a bad situation. Is that very common, or maybe even a different question is, could it be common? Could we go to war if that were the standard or common view of our enemies?
I don't think so. I think that Gray, in fact, talks about that in his chapter. The persons who have that kind of attitude toward their enemy have a difficult time sustaining any kind of war-making activity toward them. It seems that war demands of us a certain kind of dehumanization of our enemy in order for us to conduct ourselves the way that war is typically conducted. We have to see them as something other than ourselves, something usually less than ourselves, something maybe in a theological sense, something as being evil over against our good. And so I don't know that for a sustained period of time we could conduct war if we just saw the enemy as fellow human beings like ourselves. So I think in some respects, the institution of war demands persons constructing these less than human images of their enemy.
Can you give examples of these less than human images of the enemy?
Well, I think I can point to another book that subsequently in my life was important for understanding this, and this is a book by John Dower called War Without Mercy, where he describes the portrayal of the Japanese during World War II. And he describes it not only in terms of the narrative portrayals that were Japanese were described as subhuman, as one step away from barbarians, but he uses a number of cartoons in his book that were popular cartoons, Life magazine, Time magazine, and during the time of World War II, which actually portrayed the Japanese as monkeys or apes. And he says that it was necessary to portray the Japanese as something less than human beings. There was even talk during World War II of the Japanese as being part of the missing link in an evolutionary scale. And he said it was that construction of the image of the Japanese people that allowed the U.S. to conduct the very vicious war that they did against the Japanese. He said it was so effective, in fact, in his book, that by the end of World War II, there was a survey done that nearly 15% of the American public wished that the Japanese race would be extinguished as a result of the war. 25% of the American people in a survey done in Fortune magazine wished that the U.S. had more time to drop more atomic bombs than they did before the Japanese surrendered. So I think that's a historical example of portraying a people as something less than human beings. In this case, they were portrayed as apes or as monkeys. And I think it helps to explain our conduct, but it really is something that as a human being now in an institution where we try to develop a global understanding of all peoples around the world, it's something we need to continually struggle against, that we don't objectify and turn the other into something less than we are.
Okay. And that often happens. It seems to me that the point you're trying to make often happens even if we're not actively engaged in conflict, but potentially engaged. But I think, for example, about how the attitude toward the Chinese people changed from the time of Korea and changed when Nixon went to China.
That's right.
That the Chinese, like the Japanese, were somehow subhuman creatures. They mm-hmm. were profoundly immoral. And then all of a sudden, with the visit of Nixon to China, you get all these stories showing up in the newspaper about how ingenious they are and how kind they mm-hmm. are. And somehow now all of a sudden the image has to change because our relationship with them is no longer adversarial, or at least not wholly adversarial. Mm-hmm. We're looking for something more positive.
I think the China example is a good example. In my lifetime, the example toward the Russian people would be another example. The example of the Japanese is probably the most compelling because of the difference between 1945 view of a Japanese citizen and the 1995 view is remarkable, because by 1995, Japanese had become exemplary human beings in terms of industry and creativity and intelligence, and over a 50-year period in the American public had a radical change of image of what 50 years ago, 55 years ago, was an enemy for the American people.
Yeah. Well, now, you said that the fact that we construct these images of the enemy is important for understanding why we get into war, how we sustain war. Could you amplify on that, please?
Well, I think that what war calls on us to do is to kill other people. And if we are raised in moral societies like we are, we're raised in a society that tells us that, in fact, other human beings are important to us. We have to go against that moral training that we've had in order to distinguish the killing that we do in war from the killing that we know to be wrong in our everyday life. And the only way we can do that, I think, is to construct some kind of image that shows that this isn't another human being. This isn't the kind of person that I've been taught since I was a young boy or young girl that I shouldn't do bad things to. This is someone that I should do these bad things to. And so I have to overcome a whole culture's moral set of mores and moral understandings in order for me to do in warfare what I know I shouldn't do in normal life.
Well, okay. I can understand it, but I can also imagine listeners sitting there saying, but, okay, maybe we overdid it. Maybe we overdid it by painting the Japanese as monkeys. But the fact is they were, someone might say, moral monsters by things they did, or the Germans in their execution of the Jews were moral monsters, and the only way to respond to moral monsters is to go to war with them. And there's an image of the enemy for sure, but it turns out to be a correct one.
The correct one. Well, that's an interesting observation, and I guess my first response would be to say, well, that may be true. I mean, if you concede that that's true for some of the leaders or some of the persons, that's one thing. But to describe an entire race that way, I think it's a serious moral problem. It's a problem of taking the conduct of a few individuals or a set of individuals and attributing it to the entire group, which is something that we need to be very wary of. But secondly, I would say even more profoundly, that part of my interest in the image of the enemy is my coming understanding to the idea that people actually respond in ways of how we project an image of them and the images that we project of them. And if we project image of bestiality or evil onto people, it doesn't surprise me that they respond that way. If we do this with children, I think we can expect that kind of thing to happen as well. If we, the images that we have of ourselves are often images that we've picked up from those around us who are giving us feedback on who we are. And if we treat people as if they were subhuman, I think that they may act as subhuman. So part of the issue, if you raise that question, now is that image correct? It might be correct, but it might also be correct because that's the image we projected, and so that we bear some responsibility or a considerable amount of responsibility in that relationship. Self-image is very frequently a product of the image presented to you by those around you.
Okay, I'd like to explore both of those ideas in a little more detail. But let me pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is William Hawk, Vice President and Academic Dean at Eastern Mennonite University, and our topic is Images of the Enemy. Okay, there were two points you made about my last question, and again, I'd like to maybe look at each one of them. The first is that perhaps some of the individuals involved in those regimes behaved very badly. I mean, in fact, that's probably a gross understatement.
Yes.
And yet, to treat the entire race or the entire people as having those same characteristics is inappropriate or immoral or unfair. Could you elaborate on that theme, and particularly how it connects with the issue of war, with the appropriate sort of conduct in war?
Well, if you go back to the initial premise taken from Gray's book on Image of the Enemy, that many of the soldiers in World War II weren't the decision makers. They weren't the ones who were deciding either to go to or not to go to war. They were there because they were loyal citizens. They were there because they were drafted. They were there because they volunteered, because they saw this as an enterprise that their country called them to do. And they... The same way that ours would. And so that they don't necessarily, and I think the U.S. response to the German war was a little bit different than it was the Japanese war in this respect, because in the German war, the U.S. response was we were fighting the Nazis and not the Germans. And the Nazis were portrayed as the evil group, not the entire German population. We couldn't pull that off as an American culture, because we knew that so much of our own culture came from Germanic background. We couldn't see the Germans as evil, but we could see the Nazis as evil. And so that allowed us to make that distinction, so we were fighting this war against Nazis and not against our own German heritage. In Japan, we didn't make that distinction. It was against the entire population. But I think that probably the experience of the Japanese soldier wasn't that much different than from the experience of the German soldier fighting under the Nazis. They were there as soldiers under direction, under orders from their superiors, fighting a battle that they may or may not have been believers in.
Okay. So it makes a difference not only when it comes to the fact that innocent civilians might be killed, but the soldiers that you're facing are not going to have the traits, or very likely not going to have the traits of the evil leaders.
That's right. Some of them may. I mean, but the ones that do have that, or the ones who have accepted the image of the enemy from the other side. And they're the way, if Gray's portrayal is correct, their conduct, their most belligerent, their most villainous conduct toward their adversary is part and parcel of their having an image of their enemy, which is seeing it either as subhuman, animalistic, or something evil, and against their against their view of God and civilization.
Okay. In fact, would that provide us a way to get into your other point about projection? In fact, I suppose it's sort of an elaboration of the point of projection. Your original point of projection was, if I see you as subhuman, then you may treat me, you may behave subhumanly. The cycle might actually be differently. If I treat you as subhuman or see you as subhuman, I'm liable to treat you in certain ways that may lead you to believe that I'm subhuman,
right?
Which leads you to react, to create a certain image of me and to treat me in certain ways.
That's right.
Because of that.
That's right.
So that it becomes a vicious cycle, and the more out of control I get to try to stop you, the more out of control you may get to try to stop me.
And I think that being a human being and being a civilized human being that operates in a moral order is a delicate achievement. And those ways in which we treat other human beings like ourselves that undermines that delicate achievement actually puts the whole civilization at risk. I think that we experienced that during the Cold War when the whole civilization was on the brink of nuclear catastrophe because of these varying images of each other and treating each other as if we're expendable human beings and only there for the outcomes of political process. It's so many of us are so close to being something less than what our aspiration for it is to be a human being, and it doesn't take much sometimes to provoke us to go to a lower level, and that's what I fear, and that's what I, as an administrator of an educational institution, what we work on with students to try to see that conduct that took place during war is something that any of us are capable of, under the right situation, under the right understanding of who we're working with and who we're fighting with, and what we have to do is try to make this delicate achievement of being a civilized, moral human being something that can't be undone by someone else's conduct, or by our own image of what that someone else is like.
Hmm. Well, now that we're talking, I realize that one of the books I read in preparing for the series was a book by, I believe, Colonel, if I'm wrong about that, I apologize to him, named Harry Summers, a book called On Strategy, which was an evaluation of the war in Vietnam. And obviously he was a Vietnam soldier, is a career military officer. And he ends up saying that one of the reasons the U.S. lost the war in Vietnam, in essence, was that Johnson tried to carry out a war in which he didn't raise the ire of the American people against the enemy. Mm-hmm. And that was a fundamental mistake. The impression seemed to be that you couldn't fight in Vietnam, and perhaps you couldn't fight anywhere, if you don't involve the people in hating the enemy in some important sense.
I don't think I would disagree with that. I think that probably that assessment of the Vietnam War may be correct. The moral tragedy of that is to try to conduct the war in the first place. But that seems to me that observation is one that I would concur with, that conducting warfare requires not just military strategy and technology and hardware and firepower. It requires a mental attitude for your population, and especially for your soldiers. And that has to be constructed, and the enemy has to be seen as something less than human. Otherwise, you can't fight and win the war.
Okay.
I think that we have so many wars that are going on around the world now that are much, we don't have international wars, or we don't have world wars, but we have a lot of wars that are going on where this kind of construction of an image of the enemy as the other is what's dominating the conflict. And those pictures and those images become so solidified that it becomes very difficult to work for peace in those contexts. But we have a lot of people at our institution who are trying to do that, who get into the situation and basically try to find an opportunity for people to talk with each other and see each other as human beings, to have an opportunity to eat with each other as human beings, sometimes even sing with each other. Different ways of trying to make a connection between human beings when there's an image of each other that keeps them seriously apart.
Okay, so one of the lessons of understanding the importance of images of the enemy, it's not just sort of a sociological point, is that if you understand that the way that conflicts arise and are sustained is by having certain images of the enemy, then the central way to avoid and or to resolve those conflicts is to try to change those images.
Try to change those images. First of all, guard against you, yourself having an image of someone else. But you also need to make sure that other people aren't getting an image of you that is something less than human, because that can be equally serious in terms of leading to warfare. You need to continue to remain a civil human being through the conflict and respond to other people as human beings rather than as objects or someone to be manipulated or someone to be controlled.
So does this give us some sense about what we might need to do if we want to avoid war in the future?
Well, I think it gives us a lot of direction, and the direction is to keep the communication going between those persons that might have conflicting interests. That we were going to have conflicting interests throughout our history, and we should expect that, but we need to make sure that conflicting interests don't undermine our mutual perception as human beings. And so that calls for communication, that calls for dialogue, that calls for opportunities in which people see each other as human beings. This just came to me, but that's one reason why things such as the Olympics, which is seen in its political significance, and it does have political significance, is so important, because it sees people from all over the world as on the same playing field, in the same arena, as human beings doing the same, with the same types of aspirations and hopes and dreams.
Okay,
and
so
that helps to prevent warfare among peoples.
Okay. Though even there, it's still very highly competitive, and it's nationalistic.
It's all of those things, but it's still a competitive among human beings, and so they don't do the things to each other, and they can't do the things to each other that we do to each other during warfare.
Okay, and so part of the solution then of trying to deal with war is to create a new environment in which we relate to each other as individuals and as countries.
That's a new environment, and it can be very competitive. It can be a situation where we try to do our best and maybe try to do better than everyone else. But it's not a situation in which we try to kill other people as a result of that.
All right, let me ask. Earlier on, in response to one of my questions, you talked about the importance of this in the moral order. And I take it that you think that the lesson of talking about images of the enemy goes beyond war.
It does.
Into our ordinary moral relations. Could you elaborate on that?
There are a lot of places where you could go on with that one, Hugh. I know that one place that I've been particularly interested in because of work I had done in another institution and work we're doing at our institution now in terms of restorative justice, which deals with trying to bring together victims and offenders in the criminal justice system, is that in our society, especially in U.S. society right now, the persons that, as a group, that we probably do the most, we have the most dehumanizing images of are persons who are under penitentiaries, right? Persons who are under prisons. And we have so many young men and women, and now old men and women, are penitentiaries that have been dehumanized and treated as something less than human beings. We have a faculty member who recently did a book called Doing Life, which was a photo essay on men and women in Pennsylvania doing life sentences, where the photographs are not the typical criminal justice police photographs, which dehumanizes persons and makes them look as something other and to be feared. But the photographs are humanizing photographs, where these men and women who have life sentences are in normal clothes, and they might have a smile on their face, or the woman might be wearing a piece of jewelry. The angle isn't just an upright, rigid angle before a dark screen, and they might be leaning over a chair. And you see these people in the images, and then you have the quotes from them about their experience in prison, and you get a totally different image of what someone doing a life sentence might be like. It might be like your mother or your brother or someone who's closely related to you. And I think that's important for our treatment of criminal offenders in our society.
Are there other examples?
Well, I think that there'd be examples that you could do. There'd be one way of analyzing some of the gender conflicts in our society along the same lines, that people can get highly politicized portraits of the other gender, and then they start to behave in different ways. I mean, men that characteristically or typically are charged with treating women as sexual objects. And that seems to be true. And if you listen or hear the stories It seems to be true in some cases, some of the bad cases. To hear the stories of Ted Bundy or someone like that, you hear him say, before he was executed, you hear him say that he started off looking at pornography when he was a young boy, and that portrays a certain kind of image of what a woman is, and that led to his criminal behavior, may have at least contributed to part of his criminal behavior. And similarly, those persons who take a highly politicized gender view against men in our society sometimes portray all men as if, according to a certain current stereotype in some of the literature, that I think that at least when I'm the object of that portrayal, I want to reinsert my humanity in that context.
I could imagine someone listening to this interview saying, gee, all this sounds very nice, but it seems to deny or comes close to denying the fact that sometimes people just do grossly immoral actions, behave in grossly immoral mm-hmm. ways, and you know, the issue could happen in war, it could happen with criminals. You mentioned Ted Bundy. Ted Bundy just did horrible
yeah,
things,
he did.
And so you could say he's just a moral monster, and perhaps some men do behave terribly mm-hmm. badly, and perhaps some women do behave terribly mm-hmm. badly. Does this require giving up our judgments about the kinds of behavior that some people engage in?
No, I'm not. We wouldn't want to say that Ted Bundy did very bad things and did very immoral things, and Ted Bundy should have been punished even for what he did. But I guess what I'm saying is that there was a history and a context that Ted Bundy came out of. I mean, Ted Bundy wasn't born, I don't believe, a mass murderer. I think there was either a private experience or a personal culture that helped to create the Ted Bundy that existed. I don't want to deny his responsibility for what he did. I think that human beings are responsible for their conduct, but we, as educators and as persons who are concerned about the moral fabric of our society, we need to see our own responsibility in that context for helping people to develop positive images about themselves, and see our own responsibility when we're contributing to an image that might turn someone else into, or contribute to turning someone else into a mass murderer.
Okay, so it's not so much that realizing this past eliminates personal responsibility,
no.
It simply enhances understanding.
Enhances understanding, and basically my concern is to see where we can intervene in that situation to bring new portraits of people to try to stop patterns that have been created. And more importantly, when we're looking at our own children and developing the next generation, that we watch out for creating situations where these images take control and form lives. And that formation can be so devastating for a person's moral character.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for appearing in the show.
Thank you.
I've been talking today with William Hawk, Vice President and Academic Dean at Eastern Illinois University. This is Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good day.